This morning when I looked out and I saw the snow swirling around and realized how cold it was, it reminded me of one of the stories I heard from Garrison Keillor on the Prairie Home Companion, how he talked about how there was this guy that moved to Lake Wobegon and he was from California, married a girl there, and so they settled down in Lake Wobegon, and when it was like on these days, he could never get his car started. He always flooded it out. The neighbor would have to come over and start his car for him. I guess that's one of the things we learn living in the cold places, how to get that car rolling on these cold mornings. It looks like everyone did okay. Here we are. So congratulations on that, and a little sacrifice for the Lord braving the elements to be here. And so we look at this first reading, and here Moses is telling the people that we have to remember all the good things that God has done for us. And I think sometimes we take so much for granted. You know, every breath that we breathe, every beat of our heart, every day that the sun comes up is a gift of God. And these are the things that He gives us. And Moses is reminding them the same. Look, you were slaves in Egypt, and He brought you out of Egypt. He brought you through the Red Sea. He brought you to this land flowing with milk and honey. And is your offering in any way commensurate with that? You know, we're talking about stewardship and being good stewards. And we can ask ourselves, you know, is my offering, does it in some way reflect my gratitude to God for all the good He does for us? And we can think about that as we make our financial plans and fill out our taxes and all that for this year. And that's the point that Moses was trying to make to the people, that how could you lack faith and confidence in God? Seeing all that He's done for us. And you show that faith and confidence by making your offering. Obviously, there's nothing we can give God that will ever measure up to all that He does for us. But it's not so much an objective thing, well, God does this and I do this, but it's more of a subjective thing that I have this sense of gratitude that says, okay, I'm going to make this amount of sacrifice for God. And so we can think about that. And then in the second reading, St. Paul talks about this great faith and confidence again that we should have in God. And he says, if we have this great faith and we say it with our word, that we believe in the one true God, and that with our whole hearts we believe in His resurrection, then we will be saved. Now, we can take this very legalistic and minimalistic and say, okay, I believe in God and with my whole heart in His resurrection, I'm done, I'm saved, I can do whatever I want now for the rest of my life and I'm going to heaven. Is that really what St. Paul is saying? If it was, it would sort of make every other book in the Bible sort of useless, if that's truly what he was saying. But we have to understand that in two ways. First, in the context of the culture in which he was writing. The culture in which he was writing was an oral one. There weren't books. There was only one library in the world in Alexandria, and it was full of scrolls, not books. And only about 5% of the population could go in there and actually be able to read what was there. And so it was an oral society. There weren't written contracts. And so anybody who had to do any type of business, even farmers selling their goods, they did it on their reputation, on the goodness of their word, on the firmness and loyalty of their promise. And so when St. Paul says, give your word of faith, that's what he's talking about. That word that you live by, that word that is the foundation of your business, of your negotiating, of your ability to sell your goods. And so it's not just a flippant word. It's your complete truth, truthfulness, and sincerity on the line. And then when he says, say in the depths of your heart, believe in the depths of your heart that the Lord is risen. Well, for the ancients, when they talked about the desires and the thoughts of the heart, what were they talking about? They were talking about the fullness of our will, the complete, undivided direction of our will, the deepest desires of our being. And so when he says, with your whole heart, believe in the resurrection, he's saying, give your heart over to God, all of your love, your greatest desire, the first commandment, God above all things. And if you do that, you will be saved. And then if we read those lines like that, then it goes coherently with everything else that St. Paul says. So when he says, you know, be kind to your neighbor, and do this other thing, and have these good works, well, then that all makes sense. Because how could we love God with all our heart and refuse to do His will? How could we love God with all our heart and not love what He loves, which is every other person? And so these are the things that St. Paul is motivating us to in this second reading. Again, that all goes over the foundation of that love and confidence in God. I have that faith and confidence. That's why I can love Him with my whole heart. I know I will not be defrauded. And so then when we come to this gospel, we see Jesus live this out in a very real way. He goes into the desert and fasts for 40 days. Now, I can remember when I was a kid, 10 or 11 years old, and there were some prisoners in Northern Ireland that went on a hunger strike, and they were showing them on the news every 5 or 6 days, and they got up the 40th day, and these guys could hardly even walk. Okay, so this is where Jesus was after these 40 days. And after these 40 days, he was still able to resist food. Now imagine what kind of dedication he has to the will of his Father. What kind of love he has for the Father and the Holy Spirit. He was fully human. He felt every bit of hunger that we would feel if we went 40 days without food. And yet, he was able to deny that for the love of God and stand up to the temptations of the evil one. And so that's the first thing. He was able to overcome his base bodily desires and passions and live truly for God. The second temptation, I will give you all the kingdoms of the world and all this glory. And he resists again. It's the temptation of pride. This is where Adam and Eve fell at the tree, the temptation to pride. Satan said to them, you will become like God. You will see all things, good and evil. And that's where they fell. They wanted to be like God, just like Satan did. That's how he became Satan, because he was Lucifer before, and he was the angel of light and the greatest angel, and he tried to overtake God. And so he gives that same temptation to Adam and Eve, and they fall. He gives the same temptation to Christ, and even greater. And Jesus holds firm. So where Adam and Eve failed at the tree, Jesus is now successful. And then the third temptation puts him on the temple and tries to get him to manipulate the Father on his own behalf. Again, a sort of temptation to pride, to show that he can make the Father do his bidding. And Jesus says, no, you shall not put the Lord thy God to the test. And so he overcomes that one as well. And it says many others. And then finally Satan gave up and left him alone for a time. Okay, and that's the way that Jesus is showing us how our spiritual lives are going to be. When we get into our spiritual life and we're moving forward in our prayer life and getting closer to God, there are going to be times of serious temptation where God is going to allow us to be tried. And we overcome those temptations, and then we have a time of bonanza and a beautiful time of consolation, and then it comes again as we keep moving up that ladder of holiness. And if we read the lives of the saints, they all talk about this. And so that's what Jesus is showing us there. And then there's another very important point here about our spiritual lives. And that is that temptations, it doesn't matter, it's not the number of temptations that we have that makes us holy or evil. Oh, I have so many temptations, I must be a bad person. No. It's how we deal with them that makes us holy or evil. And so I may have 1,000 temptations a day, but if 1,000 times a day I overcome those temptations, I've made 1,000 steps in holiness. I've done 1,000 acts where I've shown God how much I've loved Him. I've had 1,000 details of love with the Lord. And vice versa. If I have 1,000 temptations, 1,000 times I've given, 1,000 times I've told God I don't love you more than this. And so temptations are neutral in themselves. but it's how we deal with them that makes them good or bad. And so oftentimes saints have talked about how when they get a lot of temptation, they see it as an act of love of God. God is giving this opportunity to grow in love for Him, to become holier, to become stronger in their intentions and in their love for God by overcoming these temptations. It's like a coach who makes you exercise more so that you can win. And that's the way the saints talk about it so often. And they say things like, the blows of God are blows of love. That when he punishes us times, or it seems like he's punishing us with more temptation or abandoning us to these temptations, it's really not that at all. It's he's pushing us closer to him. He's drawing us closer to him, strengthening us in our resolve to truly love him above all things and do all things for him. And so these are the things that Jesus teaches us here. But again, where does he get this motivation for this fidelity in the face of these great temptations and his suffering? His confidence and faith in the Father. And so that's the strain that runs through all three of our readings today, this confidence that we need to have, this confidence and faith that then we say, okay, I'm not just betting wildly when I decide to live for God. I'm not just throwing my money to the wind. But I am betting on that which is most sound, which is most firm, the love of God and my confidence in Him, and that He will be there for me always and give me what I truly and most want, and that is eternal life.